it's a stranglehold on the next 50 years of technology.
Remember, China manufactures one third of all products in the world. One third. So whatever you have in your house, at least one third of it's made in China. And suddenly, you know, in an extreme situation, China could just shut down all of our vehicle assembly plants in Europe and the United States overnight. It's like two tectonic plates pressed up against each other and something's going to give. They have a map, Farzad, of the United States. And on that map, they have the picture of the governor of each state. And next to the picture of the governor of each state, they have a grade, friendliness to China. Okay. And since then, they've been planning on, we've been around for thousands of years. We had a bad run there for 100 years. We're going to make things come our way again. That's where we are right now.
So we have Michael Dunn back on the podcast here. Michael's a friend of the show. We've had him on multiple times. He has given absolutely brilliant insights into not just the state of the auto market in international markets and domestic here in the United States, but just a broader macro view into all the different things that plug into different industries. And there's so many things that we can talk about today, especially related to like this changing world order that we're going through right now. It's very obvious to see that with the negotiations between the Trump administration and the Xi party, the CCP, you can see that, you know, this started with the Trump tariffs back, it feels like 10 years ago, Michael.
Yes, yes, it does.
I feel like that was like a sort of like a, like we hit the chasm for us to start reshifting the global order a little bit. But with that conversation comes a lot of different things that we can talk about. There's a few topics we want to hit. One of the big ones is going to be how China is looking to really leverage their manufacturing muscle and their expertise on the rest of the world and using that as leverage to get what they want. So Michael has a lot of thoughts and insights about that. There's a couple other things we want to hit around some of the restrictions that are going on in the auto market and other markets as well around magnets and batteries. We have some insights around Europe. Which one did you want to start with, Michael? Which one is front of mind you think that will frame this conversation from your
standpoint? I think the easiest, let's start with cars, because everybody can envision cars, and China is the biggest manufacturer and consumer of cars globally, the biggest in EVs.
Yeah,
they're the new kid on the new sheriff in town, really, genuinely today. So how did that happen, and what does it mean for us here in America? Maybe I start, Farzad, with a story, and that is, you may recall that I went straight to China right out of school, weeks after graduating from the University of Michigan, 1990, started a company, and that company's ambition was to bring Cadillacs and Chevys and Fords from America and sell them to Chinese consumers. Small problem in 1990. Nobody in China had money for a car. It was all bicycles. So I got on the ground there and everybody's looking around at, are you out of your mind? What are you doing here? There's nobody's going to buy a Cadillac. We make like $300 a year. So one thing led to another and the income started to rise. And all of a sudden here comes the Cadillacs and the Chevys and they formed joint ventures with the Chinese. I had a staff there. I started a company. And one day I turned to my A staffer. His name was Chu Qing. I said, what do you think of this arrangement where global automakers are coming to China, forming joint ventures with Chinese companies to manufacture global brands for sale here in China? You didn't see Chinese cars. You only saw the global Toyotas and Buicks and Hyundais and Hondas. So he paused for a long second. And then he said, it's okay until we kick your asses out of here.
Mm.
Whoa. That was many years ago, as far as that, but it stuck in my mind. It's personal. And China has had an ambition for decades to shake off the yoke of, you know, foreigners and global automakers in their country and be in charge of their own market. And for that matter, extend that power globally. So for the next several decades, the twist in the story is for the 2000s and 2010s, for much of that time, it was a absolute, a phenomenal run for global automakers. Chinese consumers loved the Toyotas and Mercedes and BMWs and Buicks and Cadillacs. And up until just 5 years ago, global automakers had growth and profits forever in China.
And just to really like set the reason why for the audience is like that these are 1.4 billion people with a massively expanding economy because of the decisions that the CCP made around trying to make this hybrid model of capitalism and this, you know, sort of socialism, communism thing that got going on. But basically their version of opening up the markets, and you essentially allow 1.4 billion people drive a gigantic opening of the economy, and basically anything can flood in there. And so for a while there, a lot of companies, not just automakers, but a lot of different industry that the Chinese wanted to pick and choose, essentially had infinite TAM to grow into. Right.
You are absolutely, I couldn't have said it better. Countries and companies from all over the world converged on China because it was potentially a massive market. Yeah. So the Chinese saw billions and billions of dollars flooding in, technologies flooding in, everybody in the world getting in line to get in China. And that produced overnight sensation of wealth for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And what Chinese like to do is project success and image. And the best way to do that was look at my new Mercedes-Benz.
Yeah.
Not so much for the joy of driving, but for the joy of showing others I've arrived.
Yeah.
And so for most of my years in China, it was all about, you know, who has the nicest global brand. And to put that into perspective, German luxury brands like Audi, Mercedes, and BMW were godlike in China. Like, wow. Those are just amazing brands that will be forever brands and profit machines for those automakers. But starting about 10 years ago, new guy in charge, Xi Jinping, says, two problems. One, we're running on gasoline-powered cars. That means we're now the world's largest importer of oil. That's costing us $100 billion a year. Don't like that. Don't like dependence on the Middle East. And two, how come all the cars on the road are still foreign brands? Where are our Chinese brands? So he put into motion something called Made in China 2025, a blueprint to say, we're going to transform our industry to become electric and Chinese. And so for the first several years of that initiative, everyone kind of laughed because Chinese consumers, we knew, didn't like Chinese brands and they didn't like electric cars. And that all began to change. And I might be getting ahead of the story a little bit, but it really began to change in a revolutionary way when Tesla entered and started to manufacture in Shanghai at the Shanghai Gigafactory in 2020. Suddenly, I saw my Chinese friends go, wow, electric cars can be cool, aspirational, even better than the foreign, you know, these other foreign brands we've been driving in.
And profitable.
And profitable. And profitable. Yes. Whoa, what is going on here?
Yeah.
And then the Chinese government wants everybody to swing electric. So they put in place all kinds of subsidies for the manufacturers, for the consumers. And I know numbers come and go far as that, and they're hard to imagine, but just bear with me here. In 2020, electrics were about 5% of new car sales in China. This year, they'll be half. So in the world's largest market, you're going from a tiny little sliver to half of the market.
Go ahead, sorry, please.
Yeah, from a million cars, EVs a year sold, to 13 million a year sold this year. That's just unfathomable. It's like the size of the US market coming on stream in the space of a few years in China.
Just EVs. That's insane.
Yeah, so it's Tesla plus a bunch of Chinese brands. And the global automakers who were there were looking around going, whoa, what happened to my Chinese consumer who loved my gasoline-powered car? They vanished. Where'd they go? And so you find the global automakers collapsing in China, sitting on massive factories, idle, losing money, and wondering, what the hell do we do now? Should we just go home? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, layer on top of that. And stop me at any moment, because there's
keep going.
China started to get this leverage where we're making our own vehicles, they're electric, we're not importing as much oil, it's our brands. Not only did they have EV makers, but they also invested in batteries and battery supply chains. And that's crucially important to us, not just for the auto industry, but get this, for national security.
Yeah.
Because batteries and battery supply chains and magnets are exactly the elements that are going to power the next generation of technologies. We're talking humanoid robots, drones, fighter jets. They all need these materials. China has a stranglehold on them. And just last week said, oh, by the way, remember my friend who said we're going to kick your asses out?
Yeah.
Not only are they kicking the asses out, but they're saying from now on, if you'd like access to these materials that are crucial to your national security, just check, get in line. By the way, just get in line.
So describe that dynamic, right? Because this is something that has that we just saw a development of the last couple of days. Another variable I want to throw in there too, with the battery piece. Another development we've had in the last few years that is also crucially important is artificial intelligence development. And artificial intelligence development is massively power hungry. And knowing that China's moving, it's trying to electrify its power generation sources as much as possible using solar. You know, solar is one of the big pieces they're going through, but battery storage, which requires a battery, is going to be a giant piece of that puzzle. And so all that supply chain investment I've made, not just for the next generation industrials, like your fighter jets and your drones and humanoids and all that stuff, but it's also going to be used to power the AI data centers that are going to run inference and training for the AI capabilities. So this is like a stranglehold on the next 50 years of technology.
It is, and it's real. Yeah. And what do we do about it? We're sort of in a state of shock. Everything has swung in China's favor, apparently. You know, they have the batteries. They have the energy storage systems. And we don't, as far as that. We're 10 years behind. You know, if it weren't for Tesla, we'd be 25 years behind. So they have the scale. They have the investment. They have the supply chains. They have the materials. They have the processing of the materials. It's so one-sided. One way to think about it recently, I was thinking, Farzad, is if we think about the global battery and energy storage industry, it's basically China. Yeah. And then you've got a few little things going on in Japan and Korea, here in the United States, but most of it is centered right in the Middle Kingdom, and they know it, and they know how to maximize leverage around that. So this is what our President Trump and Treasurer,
Bessent.
He's looking at like, wow, they have all the goods. And the way he framed it is, we can't have the bureaucrats in China decide who gets what materials in the world. Yeah. Well, China thinks it's okay.
Thank you to the sponsor of this podcast, Rebellionaire. Rebellionaire partners with Tesla investors who have at least $2 million in Tesla stock to reach their financial goals. Other investment firms might look at your Tesla position and think, wow, you have way too much. This is way too risky. But Rebellionaire actually embraces the long-term potential of a company like Tesla. They'll also look to maximize your profits by employing different tactics like selling covered calls, adding or trimming, etc. And the Rebellionaire team, which includes Bradford Ferguson and Matt Smith, they do this by spending a lot of time analyzing Tesla, the company, in very novel and unique ways. They've done things like cross-country FSD trips, the self-driving suite that Tesla has. They've done a lot of novel research around the energy sector and the humanoid robot and AI sector as well. Make sure to go to rebellionaire.com/Farzad, rebellionaire.com/Farzad, and that's how they'll know that I sent you. Thank you very much. So what I will say about that, I think one of the interesting developments around that is, if you look at in the last year, ever since we had a new administration, is that at least now it feels like we have an administration that is at least paying attention to this dynamic.
Paying attention
to it. Mm-hmm. So would you agree with that statement? Would you agree that at least we're making progress to like, actually we're opening the box and we're like, holy shit, what is in here?
instead of walking by the box and going, I hope there's nothing in there, and and it's not there. What box? There's no box. Looking straight at it and saying, wow, okay. Let's see, what leverage do we still have? We have leverage around chips. We have leverage around capital. Smart people, well, let's count up our leverage. Today, genuinely, China, when it comes to manufacturing, remember, China manufactures one-third of all products in the world. One-third. So whatever you have in your house, at least one-third of it's made in China.
This is based on units, like units created? What's the metric?
I think it's total value of manufactured products.
Okay.
Yeah. And then by 2030, they say that number is going to 50%. So It's how did this happen? We know how it happened, just as you described earlier. For decades, global companies, industrial companies across the spectrum poured into China because it was lower cost manufacturing. They had the scale, they had the low cost, and you could export from there.
Yeah.
Nobody thought this through, thinking, oh, one day we're going to wake up and they hold all the marbles and we're sort of vulnerable.
Can you get the audience caught up on the restriction of access around the magnets and the batteries, the development that just happened in the last few days here? As an example, I think that's the perfect example that says, okay, this is now China has gone from the transition of teach us how to do it to, hey, we'll compete with you, to, oh, we're the big dog, brother. Like, you're coming to us now, right?
We're the big dog.
Yeah.
So let's take magnets in particular, because the United States was the leader in this, and I'm writing a book now, Farzad, is coming up next year for Simon & Schuster. You go back in history, 1995, GM had a subsidiary called MagnaQuench, which was the world leader in magnets. And magnets are important. Think of it, you know, when you see those big wind farms and the blade is rotating. So what magnets do is they take the motion from that and turn it into electricity. And then conversely, in our Teslas, at the motor, they take the electricity from the battery and turn it into motion.
Yeah.
So, God, no magnets, no motion. Got to have the magnets to drive our Teslas or any EV. Way back when, GM was a world-class leader. China bought that company in 1995, and it's been building on that acquisition ever since. Wow, that's a long time ago. And by now, China accounts for 90% of magnet production in the world.
No way.
90%. Earlier this year, in the spring, Ford quietly had to shut down a few assembly plants here in the United States. Why? Because they couldn't get access to magnets. And it was a real shock. Wait a second, magnets. Why are we having trouble? Well, China limited access. And now, in the current negotiations the last few days, China just came out last weekend and said magnets and the materials and the machinery to make the magnets, which we happen to basically have a monopoly over, will make them available as we see fit. If you'd like to secure magnets, you have to apply for a license, and we'll permit that or we won't. And suddenly, you know, in an extreme situation, China could just shut down all of our vehicle assembly plants in Europe and the United States overnight. I mean, we've stored maybe a month's supply at the automakers, but that's how severe the situation is. And it really got the attention of the Trump administration. Okay, what are we going to do about this? Because it's not so easy. We can get there. We can do our own magnets, Farzad, but it, like anything else, it takes time. We have to invest in the mines. We have to learn how to process it. We have to learn how to manufacture it. Then China will dump magnets very cheaply onto the world market. And we go, oh, God, we're out of business. So we're a good 10 years behind. That's real. It's not an impossible situation, but it's kind of a wake-up call, similar to the Sputnik 2 moment, or Sputnik original moment, I should say, Pearl Harbor, or any other kind of like, whoa, moment. And I hope people here in the United States appreciate just how serious the situation is.
I think what's been fascinating about these tariff negotiations that China and the United States have been going back and forth with is that it's really highlighting the massive weaknesses that the United States has and the massive dependencies on the foundation of our entire industrial economy, and not just our industrial economy, but just everything. Like pharmaceuticals, manufacturing, right?
Yeah.
We're so, like, just like all 80%, like you said, 80% of the shit in our house that we use twice, that we get from Amazon, okay? Like, that's all basically made in China, you know? So it's, and so that's been extremely fascinating how the aggressive nature of the negotiations, which has created chaos and disruption in a lot of different ways. It's also very obviously shining a light on, like, okay, that's a huge problem. The magnets, huge problem. Yeah. Batteries, huge problem. Rare earths, huge problem.
Huge problem.
Like, you know, it's like there's so I guess my question is like, what's the likelihood? Okay, if you were to put your prediction hat on.
Yeah.
So we're not going to hold you accountable to this. Only I'm going to hold you accountable. Okay, Michael, okay. Just you and I, we'll make a bet in the back. No. What is the likelihood that the United States will actually, like, once the end of the negotiations arrive, how much of that is going to be, okay, China, we're going to actually entrust you with these things, but we're going to be in a symbiotic relationship where mm-hmm. you're not going to be able to put leverage on top of us anymore. We're going to trust you with the manufacturing of these things, but you're going to have to give us an equal or greater access to your economy so mm-hmm. that your dependency on us is just as important as our dependency on you versus isolationism, where the United States goes, okay, I'm just going to, fine, we'll figure something out for the next 5 to 10 years mm-hmm. with the full expectation that you're going to screw me over. And mm-hmm. so in the meantime, I'm going to make a Taiwan part two in Minnesota, let's mm-hmm. say, and I'm going to, you know, and I'm going to figure out how to, maybe I'll move some stuff to Indonesia, maybe I'll move some stuff to Thailand and Vietnam or whatever. And then I'm going to just remove my dependency on you. So then when you try to screw me over, you don't have my customers anymore. So where do you think mm-hmm. this is going? Because I don't see, like, what is the status quo is not going to continue. We're either going to become extremely co-reliant or mm-hmm. extremely isolated. So how do you see, or I could be wrong. I don't know.
No, totally. I love the way you summed it up. And I think we're at a point where something's got to give. We can't continue to be in this. It's like two tectonic plates pressed up against each other and yeah. something's going to give. Of the two scenarios you outlined, I think the most more likely one is that we go our separate ways.
Wow.
We do divide the world into democracies versus one party authoritarian regimes. You know, that's already happened.
That's a big deal.
That's a big China, Russia, North Korea, Iran. You could say, okay, that's one, that's the axis, basically. And then the United States would rally, hopefully, with around other democracies in the West, Europe, Japan, and Korea. In the business I work in, automotive, that seems to be the trend. It's like the realistic take on where is this going. Why? Because, and here was the big bet. When the United States and other Western democracies agreed for China to enter the WTO back in 2001, the huge underlying assumption was China is gradually going to integrate into the existing economic framework for the world. Mm. And they're going to play by the rules that are established by the IMF, by the WTO, by you name it. And China comes along and says, you know what? We think we have a better way. We like our way of running things, and we're not that fond of the West or the way the United States operates. So we want to be taking center stage. In fact, Xi Jinping has said as much. It's time for China to take center stage. He's also said it's time for China to make the world dependent on China and China less dependent on the rest of the world. So that's very clear. Like, they, regardless if the United States wants to de-risk or decouple, China already is started that in that direction. And I don't see it. I don't see how it can make a U-turn at this point, as far as that. So it has big implications for us. Like you said, Minnesota, what could the scenario be? Maybe the United States makes nice with Mexico and Canada, and we become this like hemispheric power, protected by oceans. And then China and Asia is another grouping. And then Europe Plus is another grouping. Yeah.
I mean, this is some big stuff, right? Uh-huh. And it's like, you know, the thing that I go to when I think about this too, it's like in the age that we're entering, because again, like we're talking about these core materials, again, are going to power the next generation technologies. But the one that's like very interesting to me is human or robots in this scenario, mm-hmm. because human or robots is the one of the most obvious examples for how these next generation technologies are going to be a gigantic national security risk. Because the sort of imagery that comes to my head, it's like, okay, what's the likelihood that Americans are going to be comfortable with a Chinese-made human or robot in their house that can basically do any task? And to me, it feels like, and vice versa, what's the likelihood that the Chinese government's going to be comfortable with millions of humanoid robots in Chinese people's homes, right? That, and their factories. Oh boy, that feels like a really big, like talk about like the ultimate spy network, you know? It's like you're basically giving each other access to everything that you have in your lands, and you have a network of millions and millions of these like cameras on legs that are extremely useful. And there's a massive forcing function for these things to be used everywhere, because the equivalent cost per hour to operate these is like $3 an hour at scale, versus, you know, like here the average physical wage is like what, $15 to $20 an hour, maybe even more now with inflation and all that stuff. So like the wage is increasing. They haven't increased as much as inflation, but we have seen some upticks in that. But anyway, that's besides the point. And so if that's true, so okay, what's the likelihood that's going to happen? And then if we want further coupling of the two bodies to move forward from where we are now, that implies something like China having access to the United States' total AI chip capacity from NVIDIA, as an example. But it also means Chinese auto manufacturers can start selling their EVs into the United States, which then puts Ford and GM out of business overnight, right? And so to me, it's like, okay, I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, is that going to be incredible for tech, for a competition? Absolutely. Yeah. Is that also a gigantic national security risk on both sides? Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Right? Yes. It's like, and you have two cultures that operate in very different ways. And so you're basically, you're trying to battle it out in each other's lands.
Yes.
You know, that seems unlikely.
Already we've seen developments with autonomous vehicles. So if we go back to the period 2016, 2017, I used to go up and down the coast here in California, and you'd be amazed by the number of Chinese autonomous vehicle companies operating in California, including doing testing. At its peak, there were 14. And to name, you know, there was Baidu was there, and WeRide and Pony and others with big offices, hiring hundreds of top flight software engineers.
They were
here in California big time. Through until like 2020. Conversely, you know, Waymo and Tesla was manufacturing there. We're looking at, well, maybe we can get into the China market. That's all dead. That's all stopped, like cold, ice cold. No American autonomous vehicle companies, aside from Tesla, and it's limited in China, are present in China. And Chinese companies, there's a tiny little sliver hanging on in California. But we're not even sure why, because they're feeling like they're not welcome and they're not wrong. So we've already seen it. Like everybody go back to their home camps, because autonomous vehicles across countries is not going to happen. And by extension, I'd anticipate the same thing with robotics. So the risks are too great. Just as you outlined, who's going to tolerate that level of risk? No, we don't want to do that.
So what's the likelihood then that China is going to say, hey, Tesla, your whole FSD thing? Like to me, it feels like, and this, I know a lot of people that watch my channel are Tesla investors and Tesla fans, but I've sort of been, I've spoken about this briefly before. I haven't really fully fleshed this out yet, but this conversation is really helping me flesh this out more. What's the likelihood that Tesla is going to be able to operate self-driving cars in China? It feels low. Because it, like, you're not really going to make an exception, are you?
For not Tesla? An exception, unless the way China works, a little bit of inside baseball in China. So when we say China, we think this big, it's a continental-sized country similar to the United States, huge, right? The way China operates is you've got, think of fiefdoms, regional fiefdoms. So the city of Shanghai, for example, and the city of Guangdong and the city of Beijing are powerful in their own right. And so in the city of Shanghai, the mayor of Shanghai is a godfather for Tesla. He wants to see Tesla do well. But his power base is greater Shanghai, maybe, you know, surrounding provinces, 100 million people. I could see possibly that he pushes through, I want Tesla to thrive, but in my kingdom. And I can't do it more than that.
But isn't that like a spit in the face of Xi? Doesn't Xi, wouldn't he have the power to say, fuck you, I'm going to remove you? Like, help me understand that.
If he wants, you're absolutely right, Xi Jinping, very powerful guy. If he wants to weigh in and say, no FSD in China, not going to happen. That's it. No discussion. It's over. But the way China works is Xi Jinping derives some of his power by allowing these fiefdoms to thrive a little bit independently, making money, drawing investors like Tesla in, generating jobs, creating technology. Ooh, this is that's actually benefiting the nation, and it makes Xi Jinping more powerful to a limit. And then he says, as long as you guys respect that I'm the guy in charge, I'll let you run. I'll let you play a little bit. But at the moment where he decides he's uncomfortable with something, instantly he can end FSD if he wants to.
Yeah.
So why am I spending a little bit of time on this, Farzad? Because having lived in China for 26 years, you get to feel a feel for the rhythm of how the country works. And it isn't a country in which Xi Jinping says, we're going to do this, and then everyone listens and goes, okay, we're going to do exactly what he said. It's more like the Communist Party sets a direction, and then they harness the energies and the initiatives of a lot of really bright entrepreneurs to go run around and make things happen. And they'll let them run around and make a lot of money, provided that they never challenge the Communist Party. So it's a lot looser than it might look from the outside. But ultimately, Xi Jinping, just as you suggested, could come in at any moment and say, ah, I just made a decision. I don't like this. It's off. And then
got it.
He has the final say.
So it's like similar to the United States in a way where the president has an executive order. And then in the United States, you either kind of follow it or you don't. You kind of, And it's like, okay, well, take it to the court. I don't give a shit. Take it to the court. Like, let's go. Like, let's hire $100 million worth of lawyers. Let's go to court. Let's let this thing play out for 10 years. And then by the time the court makes a decision, there's going to be an appeal and all this stuff. And then by then, you're three administrations removed.
Right.
So it's like, who cares? Whereas in China, it sounds like it's like each fiefdom or groupings of entrepreneurs or minds or like let's say brilliant people that want to solve for the problem, they can all chart their own path. But it's kind of like an all roads lead to home analogy, where it's like eventually the parties that get to the end point that's at the pleasure of Xi Jinping, then 100%. Those are the ones that become the norm. Is that a fair representation?
That's a very good summary of how it works.
Okay.
And knowing that even the mayor is working in conjunction with the entrepreneurs in that fiefdom to try to get wealthy and powerful, but they'll never want to cross that line. So we'll only have to look at the example of Jack Ma, Alibaba's founder. Yeah. He's cruising along, kicking, just doing great stuff, wealthy, doing amazing stuff. And then one day at a conference, he made a mistake. He called state banks no better than pawn shops. And that was it. That was it. That was too much of an insult. Went straight to Xi Jinping. He said, crossed the line. He's going to be on ice for a few years. So that's how it goes in China. How did we get here? FSD.
Yeah.
FSD. So they see Xi Jinping and the mayor of Shanghai see value in having Tesla there, innovation, Elon Musk, supply chains, next generation technologies. So they're tolerant and they'll tease it and they'll say maybe FSD and they'll allow some, but at a moment when they can do it themselves, it's over. That's China.
And that's okay. So it's going to be very interesting to see what direction the tariff negotiations end up in, this sort of this whole negotiating thing, because I think that's going to set a very clear path in how industry is going to form around the world. Like if it becomes more isolationist, then what that means is that the like local economies are going to benefit from industry coming onshoring with closer partners. Mm-hmm. Depending on what makes most sense for those partners, then those local economies are going to experience massive booms. And so in the case of Western nations, let's say the United States, like we talked about magnets, batteries, rare earths, and you can kind of go down a laundry list, manufacturing stuff like that. And I'm still, I'm still sure China and the US will still have some sort of trading that they'll agree on, but there'll be a trend. It's like, we need to see, is there a trend towards being isolated, or is there a trend towards being codependent? So like if the United States says, okay, we will let China sell 1 million EVs per year in our market, mm-hmm. or whatever. If they put a cap, I was like, you know what? We'll let you, we'll let, whatever that deal, you know, turns out to be, then that to me is a door that says, okay, we're actually going to further codependence because you are actually putting your existing manufacturing capacity here at risk with Ford and GM, and you're allowing a country, again, mm-hmm. that makes almost the equivalent of your total manufacturing capacity in the United States in just EV-powered vehicles, you know, like yes. a mixture of hybrids and pure EVs, 13 million versus, what is it, 15 million total cars sold in the United States. Yes. That's a signal that says, all right, Ford GM, if y'all don't get your shit together, it's over. We're gonna have to figure it out.
Yeah, we're going to let these guys in. There's some people talk about what they call the TikTok template. So what's that look like?
Yeah.
Means that when global automakers went into China so many years ago, China required everyone to form a joint venture, and the Chinese side had to own at least 50% of that joint venture. Those were the rules. If you wanted in, your Ford, your Toyota, Hyundai, everyone had to form a JV and give the Chinese half. In TikTok's example, it seems like something similar, where the Americans would have a majority ownership, Chinese would have a minority ownership, government may also have a share. So imagine a Chinese automaker comes in. It won't be carte blanche. You can't own 100%. Let's JV. The American is the majority. You're the minority. And I think the Chinese would still take this. Why? Because right now at home, the market's been flat for several years. There's way too many competitors, way too much capacity, price wars. No one's really making much money in China at all. They need access to Western markets for profits, in particular the U.S. So they'd be willing to give up a lot just to get in here and start selling their products.
And that's the Trump administration must know this.
Must know that. That's our number right. one leverage. I hope the Trump administration knows that and plays it to the hilt. Let's leverage the hell out of that. You guys need the U.S. market for profitability. Oh, when I talk to the Chinese, they're like, oh, we don't need the U.S. We can go anywhere else in the world. But
bullshit.
Bullshit. Like the U.S. rings is where the money is. Like that's yeah. quietly. Like they want in here. Make no mistake about it. They want in here, and they're planning to get in one way or another. Now, back to your point earlier, more manufacturing here in the United States. In order for us to hold our own against China, we probably, absolutely, in my view, have to align with Europe, Japan, and Korea to have comparable levels of scale. Without that, the risk is that the Chinese pick us off one by one. And I just came back from Europe, Farzad.
Yeah.
It's stunning to see the number of Chinese cars on the road in the UK and in Spain and Italy. Like more than 10% of new car sales this year are Chinese, up from wow. nothing a few years ago. More than 10%. People go, okay, whatever. 10%. No, that's hundreds of thousands of cars that weren't there before. And so if they sort of take down Europe, now we're looking like, oh, okay, this is getting a little bit scary. We need to get tighter with our allies.
That's fascinating. Yes. Okay. And so the Europe, which is such a crazy thing to hear that the Europeans, because they have so many auto manufacturers in Europe. There's so many, you know, like the Germans are obviously the biggest players, but the Italians got their own, the Spaniards got their
French.
Own. You know, yeah. the French, the British. I mean, I can go down a laundry list. You got the Scandinavians with Volvo. There's so many. And what was the other one? They have another one. Maybe they don't. Maybe it's just Volvo. Anyway, just a laundry list of different European brands. And yeah. so,
if we look a little bit under the surface there, though, just coming from the UK, the number one selling Chinese brand in the UK is MG. Which is a former British brand that the Chinese wow. bought 20 years ago. So they're sort of trotting into the UK going, hey, MG's back. And most consumers don't know the difference. They're buying a Chinese made car called MG. So sell 100,000 of them there this year. Then we go over to Sweden and they're going, oh, yeah, I'm buying a Swedish Volvo. Whoops, that's owned by the Chinese too. And then you look at Mercedes-Benz. Oh, Mercedes-Benz is owned. 19% of Mercedes-Benz belongs to Chinese
wow.
owners. So you're starting to see like, ooh, Europe is really in a delicate situation right now. It could, I mean.
Wow. Okay. So how much of this was a long-term strategy by China to get to this point? to where these inevitable negotiations were going to reach ahead. And then Trump just, you know, freaking bull in the China shop. It's like, all right, no, I think ultimately, if you think back to like that tariff day, you know, like Liberation Day or whatever he called it, I think that was like him literally just kicking the door down and be like, okay, enough. Yeah. I don't care where we are. Let's stop everything right now because y'all are getting too much leverage, way too much leverage. Y'all already have Apple there and Apple taught you how to make stuff. Y'all already like know how to make stuff really well. You're doing batteries like crazy. You're able to generate electricity like crazy. You're developing your own AI and you're making it open source, which is basically kneecapping our private industry here. And you're making it way more difficult for us to come out with leading models, way more expensive because you're just open sourcing everything. You already went into Europe and you're trying to take over the auto manufacturing there. You're cozying up with them because it seems like a lot of Europe kind of likes totalitarianism a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, like it seems like they're not as, you know, like I don't want to make this political, but you know, they're definitely free, but are they really? Yeah. Like there are some places where it's a little like, I'm like, so clearly China has, China has made inroads in the United States too. Like, let's not kid ourselves. Like, especially our higher education in a lot of places. Like, it's a problem.
Ever look at how much money Chinese entities have given to our most elite universities here in the United States?
Billions, right?
Billions. Wait a second. Why is China giving billions to our top universities? It's because they're nice guys? No, they're shaping things. Social media, TikTok. Local politicians, New York, they're here. I can't tell you the name of the company, but I had a meeting recently with a Chinese manufacturer, automaker. They have a map, Farzad, of the United States. And on that map, they have the picture of the governor of each state. And next to the picture of the governor of each state, they have a grade, friendliness to China.
Oh my God. Governors of each state.
Of each state. If they've done their homework, you ask anybody in America to name the I think it's like the 26 provinces of China. You know, after a few of them, people fall down. They are ready, and they know us.
My God,
there's an asymmetry. The Chinese know us so much better than we know them.
Oh yeah.
And so it's time for us to. We're kind of been sleeping. It's time for us to pick up our game a little bit. It's on. The competition is on.
We've been too distracted using their stuff.
Yeah. And we've become so many people. I was at a conference in Munich. Oh, by the way, I was at the Munich Auto Show. You wouldn't believe it. There were 9 Chinese automakers showing there, more than any German or French or Italian. There were over 100 Chinese suppliers, including AI, autonomous. You're like, wow, I called it the Chinese auto show in Munich. So it's real. They're pouring into Europe, and they tell me their number one priority is take Europe, and then they'll turn their attention to the U.S. But sorry, you're asking a question about here in the U.S.
Yeah, no. It feels like I remember reading The Art of War a few years ago. Uh-huh. And one of the themes, I'm not an expert on China at all. Like I've learned a lot of my China stuff through you, to be completely candid. Like you've been such a great teacher to me and my audience about this, like truly incredibly valuable insights. And for me, it feels like what China has executed from a strategic perspective to try and make themselves like very difficult to fight just by way of existing in other countries' culture and other countries' what they want. They just have become sort of like a thing. Like, well, if you want, like, here, like, look, we can take it away.
We're going to give that to you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And this is sort of like their strategy too. Like a lot of like the Belt and Road Initiative, like that was sort of like it seems like that initiative has kind of failed in a lot of ways because it wasn't executed at a high level. It was the economies that they went into were too unstable. Mm-hmm. I'm not super well versed in that at all. So I don't want to.
It's been mixed. It's a mixed result there. Yeah. But the ambition is clear.
Yeah.
Control. You know, there's this game, maybe I mentioned it last time, called Go in Chinese, called Wei Qi.
Sure.
Go is a board game.
Yeah.
And whereas, you know, the classic American competition is Penn State versus Michigan Saturday afternoon, just knocking heads and muscling through and who can drive the ball down the field. With
By the way, Penn State is dog shit this year.
Yeah, we're going to go there. Wow.
Thanks for bringing up my freaking open wound from this season.
I can feel it. I feel your pain. Wow.
Yeah.
But in Go, the whole strategy is to control territory, not to like go kill a pawn or a rook or something. It's like who can control the most territory. And that's what China's managed to do. So while you ask how long, I would say, you know, when you're a Chinese student at school, from a very young age, you learn about something called the 100 years of humiliation. And this is a period from 1842 when the British showed up with gunboats up the Yangtze River and defeated the Chinese. It was an embarrassment for the Chinese, humiliation. For the next 100 years, the Chinese in their mind suffered one humiliation after another. First, it was the British, then the French, and the Americans came, and the Germans, then the Japanese invaded, World War II. None of it was good for China. No good stories there. And then when Mao Zedong came to power in 1949, he said, from this moment forward, we finally stand on our own two feet and we will avenge those 100 years of humiliation. So they've got a pretty sizable chip on their shoulder.
Oh, yeah.
And since then, they've been planning on, we've been around for thousands of years. We had a bad run there for 100 years. We're going to make things come our way again. That's where we are right now in terms of motivation.
And that, and you think about the motivation there. I mean, that's pretty like, that's some serious motivation.
Serious.
Culturally, like that must be, like that must be felt through all, like every generation in China. And of course, as you're farther away from those, that 100 year, sort of like 1949, and you have, you know, the newer generations come up, and the newer generations are born into more and more modernity and like more and more comfort and and amenities and things like that. We've seen this in the West. We've seen this in multiple different ages and empires that rise and fall. Is that at a certain point the empire gets too comfortable, then you have too many generations that are born into the comfort that succeed that's succeeding, and then by the, you reach a peak of awesomeness, and then at some point, like the people that are around have never seen a tough time, like a true tough time. And they, they're weak. They don't know. Like, they're, it's not their fault. That's just what happens, you know? And so the question becomes, where is China on that trajectory? And where is the United States in that trajectory? Right? And so...
What do you think?
Bro. and this is like... This conversation has to be... And again, this, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. So this is like me trying to piece together stuff, you know?
Totally. That it's, it gets right to the heart of the matter, where we are. Because... as much as I'm here in the United States saying, hey, China's at the doorstep and they could really do us some serious damage, people look around going, life is good. What do we what do we need to get up about?
I think, I mean, my honest opinion, Michael, and I've been racking my brain on this. This is what I spend most of my time thinking about. And then like, and then the thing that always fascinates me is superseding the technology layer on top of that, the artificial intelligence layer on top of that, because that's going to be such a massive piece of this. The only way out for the United States is to, in a very weird way, embrace artificial intelligence to the maximum and embrace automation to the maximum, because that will eliminate your dependency on your biggest rival. You have to do that. And but if, so you like there's only... two outcomes. China wins because they're hungrier. They got more people. They're much more like the culture. What is it? 669? What's
their? 996.
Thank you. So, you know, they work, what is it? 9 hours a day, 6 days a week.
9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week.
Thank you. So, 12-hour days, 6 days a week. And then Sunday for rest. And then, you know, Chinese New Year, they party for 2 weeks or whatever, which they deserve, you know, whatever it is. So that's pretty lit. I mean, I wish the United States, but you wouldn't work enough to deserve that, right? But let's set that aside. So culturally, they're hungrier. They're from like, if you think about the Chinese past, like they just, you know, this is an agricultural nature, like agricultural nation. And you talked, you taught me this, right? Like a lot of rice farmers, rice, growing rice is a pain in the ass. And so a lot of generations were brought up in a time where it was a pain in the ass to survive and to live. And that is the culture that has driven China to where it is today. And yes, it doesn't feel like the newer, like we're not at the point, I don't think, in China. Like we could talk about demographics, how the one child policy kind of screwed them up a lot. But this is going to be like a 20 to 40 year time frame. So China has a 20 to 40 year window to win, because after that, they're going to be too old. Yes. And they're not going to be young enough, right? And so this is how it feels with China, is that they know their time is running out. And they know that if it's not in the next 20 to 40, they're never going to get there, because there's going to be another younger, hungrier sort of like power that's going to rise up and then take over. So they know their time is now. And so on the other side, the United States has been a land of distraction, obesity, mental illness, social media, infighting, political violence, like, you know, but on the other side, unbelievable innovation. We were living through the new Da Vinci of our time, Elon Musk, in my opinion, with his insane technological improvements. You got entrepreneurship going crazy around the world of AI. We have the best models. We have the best chips. We don't have enough energy, which China has. But now we're starting to open up the doors to generate more energy. Hopefully capitalism and the free markets take over there. And so the question becomes, is there enough hunger in the United States to leverage our geniuses and our entrepreneurial spirit to supersede 1.4 billion people that will work their ass off to win?
That is the question right
I
there.
I don't know.
That's the question.
You know?
I was at a conference recently and they said, here's the mindset that I think needs to shift is, I said, well, if the, they said, if we don't let the Chinese come in with their more affordable electric vehicles, how are you going to explain that, the question was to me, to my mother, because she can't afford cars anymore. And she has a right as an American consumer to have a more affordable vehicle. So I said, oh, we're in America so focused on consumer rights that we forgot that, hold on, how did we get here? And oh, by the way, there's something that's more important than that consumer rights, is called national security and freedom.
Crazy.
And so it was really a moment for me where you go, we're moving from a period of unbridled consumerism and a just in time. How quickly can I get it from Amazon? At what low price and high quality, to what they say in the industry now, just in case. We're really entering a new era where it's no longer certain that we could have that thing at all if we're not careful. Never mind how quickly and at what price, but we may just be out if we're not smarter about this. So I do feel that, you know, if we look at historically, the United States doesn't wake up until it wakes up. I mentioned Pearl Harbor or Sputnik. Yeah. We may unfortunately require a moment. Something happens. Something stops.
I agree.
Get everybody's attention. Otherwise, and a better would say, wow, China advantage China right now, just from the point of view of hunger and intensity.
Yeah. It feels like it has, I agree with you. It feels like it has to get worse before it gets better. My fear, and this is where I'm like, you know, I can't help but think this way. It's like, okay, in the age of automation and technology, like using the example of self-driving cars are going to bring, like, let's use Tesla Robotaxi as an example. If they're successful, they're going to bring sub 40 cents, sub 30 cent per mile costs for transportation. That's going to be phenomenal for people to be able to access cheap transportation. So it's going to solve your family member's problem. Or the, you know, the use case that you spoke about, where it's like, it's my right to have access to cheap transportation. Okay, take a robotaxi. It's going to be way cheaper than owning a car, and it's going to be comfortable. You know, you don't have to deal with nobody in the car. It's basically your car for the time that you need it. Maybe you'll rent it for $100 a month, and you can call it at any time. You have additional access to it. Whatever, you can. There's a bunch of different ways you can execute against the strategy to self-driving cars. Okay, what does that mean though? Go ahead. Yeah. Sorry.
Thanks to the Da Vinci of our time, by the way. That didn't just happen. Exactly. Right. Okay.
Blood, sweat, and tears, and decades of building out a supply chain and AI expertise to get you to a point where you can have your rights to have a cheap car. Okay, cool. Yeah. Let's set that aside. But what does that mean? That means that that technology is not going to put one of the biggest industries out of work in the United States, which is drivers. What are those drivers going? How are they going to feel? Are they going to be like, oh, no, this is good because we're competing against China? No, what they're going to say is, what the fuck? The robots just took my job. Elon Musk. And then a politician is going to come. Zoran Mamdani is going to run for president. I don't even know if he's a citizen or not. But let's just, AOC is going to run for president. She's going to say, I told you, Elon Musk hates you. He hates you. He does not like you.
Yeah. He'd put you out of work. He'd put you on the street.
He took your job. Uh-huh. Yeah. And then what's China going to be doing the whole time? They're going to be like, oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Distraction. And like that, don't get me wrong. It is going to disrupt a lot of people's livelihoods. And we need to figure out how to navigate through that. But what's the likelihood that the United States is going to be like, you know what? Everyone who's disrupted, we're going to take care of you and help you land on your feet. Yeah. And we're going to make sure that the outcome you end up in is better than your previous outcome, because we have to do this. Otherwise, China is literally going to take over.
Yeah.
And it's like it's tough to verbalize that, right? Because if Tesla doesn't do that, the United States is going to be stuck in a place where it's going to continually get older and older, and the technology is going to get poorer and poorer and worse and worse. And when people travel to places like China, they're going to be a freaking quasi-utopia with self-driving cars everywhere. Artificial intelligence everywhere. And then you look at the United States, and it's going to be people driving around in gas cars. And they're going to be like, what the hell is that?
Horses.
Horses, right? Exactly. So it's like, okay. So and then the question becomes, will the politicians in our land, and by the way, what is the likelihood that the politicians that run that sort of rhetoric are actually somehow being funded by the CCP?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very high likelihood.
Mm-hmm. So that doesn't sound and look good for the United States. It's like, and so the thing we have to make sure we don't fall for is that technological improvement and autonomy is somehow a bad thing. What we have to push for is for our government to take care of our people as we transition to this new age, to ensure that our future outcomes. And then when I say take care of our people, I don't mean like socialism or communism. Yeah. I mean like be very smart about policy so that leadership, the next generation economy is better than what we have now.
Leadership. This is what I feel is missing in our society right now. We need a vision, someone to paint a picture of the future that most people in the country can get behind and say, yes, I get it. That looks like a good future. Let's all work toward that.
Exactly.
It seems to be elusive for us. Just on your note about, falling behind, there was a moment last week. I was in the UK. I had the opportunity to drive several Chinese brands, including Zeekr, XPeng, MG, and Leap Motor. Stellantis has invested in Leap Motor. Nice vehicles at a good price. And the dealers there were like, why are you here in the UK? Well, part of the reason I'm here is to drive these cars. You don't have them in America? We have them here. You guys don't have them. These are basic Chinese cars. You don't have them in America. So it was a moment like, ooh, yeah, we probably, I understand why we don't. In fact, I don't think we should allow the Chinese in right now because we're not ready for that. But it was a moment where the rest of the world is experiencing something that Americans, and I don't think that's happened before in our lifetimes, where we don't have access to the products like that.
Yeah. So, on average, a superior product than what you can get here, right? On average,
good value, good solid value. They're not, what I would say about the Chinese cars, I've given this some thought because I'm on the plane a lot recently, is Chinese cars are, I would say, good. They're good. They're solid. They're good value for money. Some people will say they're unbelievable, amazing. I think that's a factor.
Propaganda.
Of propaganda and expectation. Like, whoa, Chinese car people can make this car. So it's beyond expectation. But then once you've driven them and you go, this is a good car. Yeah. And it's good value for
gimmicky.
Money.
Gimmicky. There's some gimmicks.
Yeah. A lot of gimmicks, a lot of features. That's sort of they get in. With the price, it's about 15% lower than the Koreans or the Japanese. And then you get in and they have a lot of digital stuff going on. And, this looks modern. You may not use it, but it makes an impression on buyers. So,
it's shock and awe, right? Like, they're very good at shock and awe. It's like, oh, wow. Like, what? Like, you can see it on TikTok all the time. It's like, look at this car. Like, the car's suspension. It's perfect. It's like, it doesn't move. And then look, you can open your door by doing a dance, and then the door opens, and then you can sit on the chair, and then the chair starts massaging your butt. Like, okay, cool. All right. Uh-huh. But, like, maybe that I don't want that. Maybe I just want a car that I don't have to drive. How about that? Right?
Perfect. The you other know? Day, they're showing me that I could boil a pot of coffee in my trunk. And I was like, okay.
Okay, thanks.
All right.
But that's an example of like the culture, right? It's like, hey, let's just try stuff, which I love. It's like the experimentation, right? It's like trial and error. Let's come out with features that people might, because, you know, if the CCP is going to backstop you from a cost perspective, maybe like just go all out, go crazy. Let's make some great stuff. You're going to start having, you know, freaking coffee makers in the trunk. And you're going to have, you know, fridges under the back seat and, you know, a freaking sound.
Cars that jump.
Yeah, exactly.
Swim in the lake. And
yeah.
Yeah.
So I think, and that's sort of been my conclusion there with that is like, when you're thinking about like actual, like, and I hate saying this because I say this all the time, and I know you said it too. It's like, the United States is so unbelievably lucky to have Elon Musk. It cannot be understated how unbelievably important this individual is to the national security of this country, because without him, we would not have electric vehicles. Without him, we would not have a rocket company that actually can get astronauts to space with an American rocket. And we wouldn't have this forcing function for entrepreneurs and companies to start taking huge risks on big ideas to actually move our country forward. If he didn't exist, that would have been delayed potentially by 10 years to 100 years.
10 to 100 years. You'd still be looking at Facebook and getting excited. Yeah.
Like, exactly. Come on.
He's really, you said it, Da Vinci, once in 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And you know, the Chinese have enormous respect and admiration for him too. Of course they do.
How could you not?
Yeah. Phenomenal.
You know? It's unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah. And without Elon, like, think about it. Where do we have the Detroit 3?
Yeah.
Look 2? No.
Yeah, we wouldn't even have OpenAI, Michael.
That's the crazy thing, right? We wouldn't have OpenAI. We wouldn't have Star. We haven't talked about Starlink.
Yeah. Starlink. Yeah, SpaceX. OpenAI was. Oh my God. Okay, I need to get off of this topic.
He's more American than like the American dream.
I had Steve Jurvetson on, who's a long time. He's one of the greatest VCs out there. He's one of the earliest investor in like Elon companies, and he very unapologetically says that like Elon is the best example of the American dream. Like, there's no better example of the American dream than Elon Musk. It's like, immigrant comes here and it completely transforms the nation, and for the life of me, like, is he perfect? Obviously not. He's got flaws just like anybody else, sometimes a little bit more flaws than other people, but what do you get on the other side? National security. He might say some crazy shit sometimes. Okay, great. But guess what? Like, we actually have a chance. He's given us a chance to actually succeed here.
We have a chance with Elon on our side.
It's crazy. Oh, man.
One more point about Elon. Just one of the things I find really refreshing, and it's nothing that you haven't heard before, but the so-called, his reference to first principles. So in the auto industry for all my life, companies have been spending tens of millions, probably hundreds of millions of dollars to research consumer preferences. Focus groups, quantitative, qualitative, all kinds of data. And I remember going to Tesla, this is probably 2017, and meeting his guy in charge of China at the time. I go, well, you're going into China. What do you know about the Chinese consumer? What would you like to know? And the guy said, nothing. Nothing. There's a billion potential customers over there. I just live there. I speak the language. I can tell you we don't need it.
Yeah,
you don't need to do the research.
Yeah.
Wow. And cool, they don't. They step into China and their cars just start taking off. It's really refreshing. Now, if you're a consumer, if you're a researcher, you'd say, "Well, but he's missing this." Now, I just like that he challenged. Do we need this? Do we need this part? Yeah. Do we need this research? Or can we do without it? Yeah.
Very Steve Jobs. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, Steve Jobs, he's a Steve Jobs, Rockefeller. Like, I just like, I don't know, just so many different people mesh, like Da Vinci. He's like just a multi multi-expert across, he's an elite 1%, top 1% across multiple facets. And then the way he can distill a very complex thing into a very easily communicated thing that most people understand, that's what his superpower, because then he can get buy-in from the public to actually, like, you know, like channels like this one exist, because it's like, okay, I get it. I get what you're trying to do. And it's pretty freaking awesome. And then here's how it's happening. And then communicate, like getting into the details of how it's actually playing out. What does it mean long term? What does it mean short term? What are the potential repercussions? What are the potential benefits, right? Like, what are the potential pitfalls? It makes it such an interesting conversation.
He's right there with us front and center. This is another kind of culture shock I experienced. And maybe you can relate to this too, is having lived in Asia, someone of his stature would be completely inaccessible.
Really?
Like behind several, especially in China, like you never really meet the mayor of Shanghai or the Xi Jinping. He's got so many layers between him, like godlike, and you don't just actually ever see them or and Elon's right there with us daily, telling us what he thinks. That was really refreshing too. He's not hiding behind his titles and his accomplishments. He's still out there.
Definitely. He's literally shit posting on X every day.
Every day.
That dude's either on the toilet all day or he has a massive addiction to the platform. And probably something tells me those two overlap quite a bit.
Right. When does he find the time to go to the... Oh, okay.
Yeah, now okay, yeah. Yeah. It's like that's one of those things. Like once you realize how busy his day is, like literally the only time he's probably on X is when he's sitting on the toilet.
Can I ask you a question about that time management?
Of course.
I read that he does 5-minute.
No, he doesn't. No. No, he does focus work for an entire day, basically. So he does one day is Tesla day, one day SpaceX day, one day. Okay. And then I just think his thing, you know, he's neuroatypical, you know, he's on the spectrum. So I think one of the superpowers he has, and as being on the spectrum is that he's able to hyper-focus on things that he really finds interesting. And he's like, it's obvious that the things he's working on, he's passionate about, right? Mm-hmm. And he sees them, each individual piece, as part of a very important piece of building a multiplanetary species and getting us to Mars and building a self-sustaining colony. If you really think about all his different companies, they are all a piece of doing that. And so everything he's working on has massive purpose. All his company's goals have a existential humanity scale mission statement that is completely and utterly undeniable. And he believes it to his core. And so that makes it very easy for him. This is why he's able to do what he can is that every time he wakes up, there is an anxiety in his body that says, if I don't get this done today, we're going to be delayed by one day to make the human species self-sustaining on Mars. And every day that passes is a day where a meteor could hit us. We could have a civilizational event that's going to wipe us out. Every single day, I think he just feels that anxiety. And that's what powers him to push through ridiculous tasks. That, to me, sounds like a terrible life, honestly. But mentally, physically, health wise but if he can find happiness in doing that, and he can find purpose in doing
purpose.
That
I think it's a purpose, right? He has a super purpose.
He's very in tune with what makes him truly feel like he's doing something good. And I think that's what powers him every day. And I think it's less about time management, honestly, and I think it's more about he's one of the very few individuals that's a marriage of having purpose, having ultimate purpose, and having the brain to be able to execute against the goals he has set for himself. And that's what makes him so special. Because those two things are rare, but when you combine those two things, and I mean people like Jensen Huang are not too dissimilar, your Steve Jobs's, even your Mark Zuckerberg's. Like these guys that obviously operate at a different level. I think it's the marriage of like those things, but then Elon is like a top one percenter in those two. Like he understands true purpose, and he has the IQ and the capability to execute against that purpose. In my opinion. That's what makes them powerful.
Jensen, I saw him give a talk recently, and he said, a lot of people ask me, you know, should they start a company? And he said, don't do it. Don't do it. unless you're absolutely positively sure you want it. It's so much stress, so much uncertainty, so much anxiety, so many sleepless nights that you got to know that you want it. And so with Jensen and with Elon, they see something and they want to go after it. But he said for most people, he would recommend something else. Arzed.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just real quick, but that's the insight. You probably have to go if I were to guess, right? Probably holding you for too long. Real quick, that insight really says everything about it, because I would tell people start a business. But the way he starts businesses, it's like go all in or die. Uh-huh. I'm like, okay, you're crazy. So it is what it is. Michael, where can people find you so I can let you go and get back to your day?
What one thing just before we go you said earlier, you made reference to Sun Tzu and the Art of War. There is a lot of wisdom in that book. If the ambition is to understand China and how Chinese people think.
Yeah.
And one of their, there's a lot of quotes in it. Some of them funny, some of them strange. But one of the major takeaways is if you know your enemy and you know yourself, in 10 million battles, you have nothing to fear. So if I were to give advice to us as Americans, I think we have a fairly decent understanding on who we are. You know, 70-30. Yeah. But in terms of, do we know our adversary or our competitive? No. So we'd be doing ourselves a huge favor just to understand where they're coming from. And I say this with the realization that it's work, because my agent recently reminded me, I'm writing this book called Car Wars. It's about the competition between the United States and China for supremacy and next generation autonomous and electric vehicles. And she said, here's the deal. Let's be honest. Most Americans, A, don't know much about China, or B, don't really care much about China.
So like, true.
So she goes, your challenge is to bring things to life in a way that people will want to, you know, learn more about it. And I understand on paper, it may not be the most exciting thing to do, but for our well-being as a nation, and our well-being as individuals, it's essential that we really get up to speed with what this thing called China is all about, and what its ambitions are, and what our options are going forward.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah. I think that's extremely well said. And I love that advice. I strongly recommend, like you said, everybody, a great starter book for everybody is reading The Art of War, because it really shines such a bright light in not only brilliant strategy, but also the Chinese playbook on how to win. And it's not about violence. And that's the beautiful thing about that book. It's not about violence. It's about control.
The control, right. He says the best battle is the one in which you don't even have to fight.
Exactly.
You've already won. So, that's
powerful.
That's unusual. The other one is called San Shi Liu Ji, Zou Wei Shan Ce. So he goes, of the 36 strategies, to run away is the best one.
Yeah.
You go, wait, hold on. In war, run away is a good strategy. Yeah. Well, that's the essence of guerrilla warfare. If you don't have an advantage, go dark. And then your opponent doesn't, where is he? Where did he go? How big is he? How strong is he?
Yeah.
Don't know. So little things like that don't occur to us, I think, as average Americans, there's a lot to learn.
For sure.
About where you're coming from.
It gives you time to really build an advantage, because you know your opponent better than your opponent knows you. And so you never want to engage ultimately you don't even want to engage. You just want to win. You just want to have so much control that when the time to quote unquote fight comes, your opponent realizes they've already lost. So they just surrender.
So for example, if you control all the rare earth and
all the batteries,
all the batteries, the and all
electricity
the
output.
Chain.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. Michael, where can people find your stuff?
Okay. So easiest is www.dunninsights.com. There you can find our newsletter, and our podcast is called Driving with Dunn. Most recently, I had the author of Apple in China on there, Patrick McGee. Great interview. If your interest is in electrics, autonomous future, China, check out the website. Love to hear from you.
Michael, it's always such a pleasure having you on, brother. It's like, it's always such a mind-expanding conversation, and you're always welcome back anytime.
Thank you so much, Farzad. Really appreciate it, being on your show.
My pleasure.